This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 40 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
David, I am so excited because I've learned that you've had a really interesting experience with a multicopter lately.
Oh, yeah. I was blessed. Last weekend, I got to do two things that is pretty awesome. For the airplane geeks, I got to go fly with the Army, United States Army Golden Knights parachute team. But for UAV Digest, Parker Joker of Propeller Heads Aerial Video took me back to his place because he works at McGuire also. And I got to fly a hexacopter for the first time. And it was a FPV hexacopter.
Cool.
And can I just say it was the most terrifying and exhilarating thing in my life? And the best part was for you listeners out there, I had it videotaped so you can watch me and you can be humiliated. So guess what the video is selfishly of the week is, huh, Max?
That's right. You've got your own video. That's great. Well, are we going to talk about that some more before we launch into the news?
Yeah. I just got the text from Parker. Ironically, I said, well, can I have the statistics on the hexacopter? And he wrote, well, it's got six motors. This is the kind of guy I'm dealing with. But it's an AGL Hobbies UAP2V2 custom hexacopter. It has two 5,000 mAh 4 batteries, and it's 11 pounds total weight, flying a Sony Nex camera on a six-axis gyroscopic gimbal and a NASA MV2 controller. And Parker made some interesting statements about flying this hex that you don't really fly it, you control it. Hmm. It does have a GPS, and if you let go of the controls, it'll sit there and hover. When we turned it on, we checked out how many satellites it was seeing, and there were 12 GPS satellites it was picking up for its system. And it really flew itself. I'm not that creative, but it was very interesting what you need to learn to fly the aircraft. And I'm very happy that we videotaped it so that Parker could show me and we can show our audience. For someone who hasn't flown one, it's a unique experience. But Parker said this is not your average run-of-the-mill hexacopter. And one of his comments was, while it flies itself, you really need to learn to fly. And Max, you are on the right track. They don't recommend you go out and fly a multi-$1,000 hexacopter, but go out and learn to fly with your little, what is it you fly now?
Yeah, it's a little Blade Nano QX, just a really small, some would kind of call it a toy quadcopter. Very, very small, $100 kind of device. But yeah, I figure if I crash that badly, I'm not out a whole lot. I understand you did not crash Parker's expensive hexacopter, though.
No, but trust me, I was shaking like a leaf for a bit while afterwards. It's a very awesome machine, and I thank Parker for the experience, and he's promised to get you in the air also, Max. And and even with the first person view, it was definitely unique. And having it videotape me while I was flying it was kind of funny. So it, thanks to Parker, and I got the bug. I don't know how I'm going to be able to afford any of it, but I definitely have a better experience now on what's involved with these kind of aerial machineries. I've flown radio-controlled airplanes before, but this was a very different experience. And I had to quickly sort of unlearn what I knew about airplanes and controlling them, because this is a whole different breed of ship.
How did you find the first-person view compared to what you've been used to with RC?
Sort of distracting. It's a different mindset. When you're constantly watching the airplane when you're doing radio control, when you're watching first-person view, you're kind of also checking out the scenery. Having it look back at you and being able to see yourself looking at it is kind of a surrealistic thing, but it definitely awesome. So when you get your first, it's kind of hard to explain. It's two experiences that I've had over the last couple of days are hard to explain to people who've never experienced it. My friend Dave went up with me in the Golden Knights, and I said to him, remember how the first time I went, I couldn't really explain to you the sensation and the way the people were? And his comment to me was, yeah, now I get it. And flying the hexacopter in first person view, it's hard to explain to my friends and my family. And they knew I was excited, but they just didn't understand what it was. So it was a real privilege and a sort of eye-opening experience.
Oh, fantastic. I'm really envious, David. I can't wait to have an opportunity like that, or at least to build up my own capabilities. How much time did you put on the copter?
You can see it in the video.
You got the whole thing. Huh? Okay.
And I have other videos that I can upload to YouTube. My friend Dave took a little bit longer to fly it, but it was kind of impressive that in 5 minutes or 6 or 7 minutes, he had me up and flying it at least to a hover and stuff. Just so I would get a sensation. You know, we've been talking about this for 40 weeks, believe it or not. And now I have a better grasp of what we're talking about. Mm. But that sort of takes all the fun out of the fact that we've always claimed we don't know what we don't know. We just talk about it.
Now you know. All right. Well, maybe we should get started with some of the news items that we've selected. Actually, mostly items that our listeners, our community have selected for us. You want to run through those, David?
Sure. We'll talk about my first choice, which was the Iranians clone an RC-170. Embry-Riddle creates an unmanned master's program. Italy looks to build a UAV school. A U.S. Airways flight encounters a UAV. I get the impression we're going to be talking about that the most. Northrop Grumman and Yamaha to build a UAV and not a motorcycle. And Parrot has a new FPV drone. Well, Max, I screwed up in the introduction just a few minutes ago, and it wasn't an RC-170 where we've got radio control in the mind. It's actually an RQ-170, the Wraith, as the Pentagon likes to call it. Well, it crashed in Iran a little in 2011, and the Iranians already have reverse engineered it and have a prototype. Well, they say they've sort of reversed engineering. We don't know how much sensitive stuff they've gotten out of it and what kind of damage is done to national security or something, but it does look like a fully functional aircraft. We'll see if they actually show us pictures of it flying.
Yeah, in the past, some of the aircraft that the Iranians have shown us have clearly been mock-ups or not flyable, just from the photos. This one maybe looks a little different. This one, it doesn't seem to feature that same kind of rough look that makes one wonder if the thing is actually flyable.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll keep an eye on it. We'll see if they actually do prove that it flies or it's just another Iranian publicity stunt. Kind of like their stealth fighter, which everybody said you can't even fit in for a pilot. So, and magically appeared over several mountains via Photoshop. So we'll keep an eye on this one. I do still find this a fascinating story that they claim to have shot it down or brought it down electronically. And doesn't seem to be the Air Force is too upset about it, but we'll go on from there. So I guess let's talk about some schooling. In the theme of me flying my first hexacopter and getting some education, a master's degree, Max?
Yeah, we see in Aviation Pros, Embry-Riddle Worldwide to launch master's degree in unmanned systems. this is something that Embry-Riddle plans to offer in August of this year, 2014. It's a Master of Science in Unmanned and Autonomous Systems Engineering. Now, there are a lot of concentrations that are offered under this degree. They include things like unmanned aerospace systems, aeronautics and design, human factors, space systems, safety, emergency response, operations, education, aviation and aerospace management, and aviation and aerospace research. So it sounds pretty comprehensive. They do have some information about the admission requirements. They do have some academic requirements for those who might be interested.
Yeah, I don't qualify. The admission requirements are a bachelor's degree in an engineering program. So there goes that thing. Grade point average of a GPO. I had that. And the GRE, or the graduate record examination, for those who don't know outside of the United States, that's equivalent to our SATs for undergraduates. Proving that you actually learned something when you were in college, in university. The degree requirements are pretty stiff. 15 credits of core courses, modern control systems, linear systems, sensors and data links, unmanned and autonomous vehicle systems, system safety and certification, and 15 credits of electives.
This program can be awarded either with a concentration in unmanned aircraft systems or without that concentration. Embry-Riddle, of course, is one of the highly regarded aerospace aviation schools. They say that this master's program, to quote them, prepares students to work in an emerging industry that designs, develops, and supports systems that operate along a spectrum of autonomy, from those remotely controlled through decreasing human interaction to full autonomy. So this is probably looking to be a very interesting program, probably one that will have a lot of value for certain groups of folks, depending on what your career aspirations are.
And it's kind of ironic because we talk about Embry-Riddle as a program that when people go to Embry-Riddle for pilot training, you know, we talk about the pilot surplus or the pilot on our other show. And here's a program that I have a feeling that if you come out of it successfully, you're going to get a job somewhere.
Yeah, and as we've said before, I think, you know, this we get some regulatory roadblocks or maybe hurdles behind us, and likely this is going to explode in terms of economic activity. And those that are preparing themselves now to position well in that kind of a growth industry will, I think, do well. And it may be getting an education like this one now. It may be becoming proficient in the operation of unmanned vehicles or something else. But if you're looking ahead, this is a great industry to be involved in. And don't just let it unfold. Make a plan and be proactive. But we see Italy is also thinking about doing some UAV schooling, aren't they?
Yeah, this was from defensenews.com. Italy may build UAV school. Well, Italy has been flying Predators for quite some time now, and evidently they're thinking about opening a UAV school. Does that mean that Piaggio hammerheads would be on the course curriculum?
Oh, wouldn't that be exciting?
I think you and I would get real excited about, here, let me show you how to fly a Piaggio hammerhead. For those who don't know, the Piaggio P-108 is also becoming a optionally manned or an autonomous UAV. And we like Piaggios.
Sure, beautiful aircraft.
But they already provide manned training to foreign pilots at Lecce facility, and they're looking up to build a school for other nations, which is kind of right in line. You know, Turkey has got a huge now infrastructure for UAVs. They're building their own as well as purchasing other ones, and this is a good thing for Italy. And for something like a NATO country, it might be able to set standards for all of the other NATO countries or European countries for operating UAVs. So having one centralized school for the European EU might not be a bad thing.
And David, this looks like this is kind of strictly focused on military UAVs. Am I correct?
I believe so, yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, having compatibility between other countries, considering everybody's getting involved with UAVs, that's a good thing. You know, I mean, standardization, we've talked about a lot, not as much as the FAA or chickens, but we do talk about standardization, and that's one of those steps in the right direction.
Mm. All right. Well, our next story comes as maybe no surprise to folks that this is very big in the news these days. We had a lot of folks in our online community send us a variety of links to different articles on this topic. This is about a close call, apparently, between some sort of a UAV and a commercial aircraft.
Okay. Right off the bat, this is ticking me off.
Why is that?
Well, let's talk about how it was revealed to the general public.
Okay.
It revealed to the general public in a presentation by the FAA on why we should not be flying drones.
Mm.
And as used as an example, well, if this was such a serious incursion, why did the FAA wait a month and then do it in a presentation to possible commercial operators of UAVs?
I think you're right. There are certain aspects of this that seem kind of, I don't want to say suspicious or funny, but just out of place. I mean, even the facts, I think, are not really well known. What we believe to be the case is that a pilot of a U.S. Airways CRJ-200 reported a, quote, near midair collision. Now, this is back on March 22nd of this year, 2014, at 2,300 feet. This was near the airport in Tallahassee, Florida. Now, the only one who observed anything was the pilot, and he reported, I don't really know, that the pilot reported that the small unmanned aircraft that was involved looked similar to an F-4 Phantom jet. I think some of the articles give the sort of additional information that it did not look like some kind of a multi-copter. And as you mentioned, David, Jim Williams, the head of the FAA's unmanned aircraft office, mentioned this in a conference. You know, some of the things that Williams said kind of make you wonder, yeah, what the motivation was here. He talked about the dangers of small UASs being ingested into an airline engine. He even raised the Miracle on the Hudson as an example of, you know, the kind of things that can happen when foreign objects are ingested into an aircraft engine. I don't know, David. It does seem kind of funny. A lot of people are curious about what's happening here. I mean, was it an F-4 drone? What do we call the F-4 drones?
A QF-4 Phantom, which they're actually flown on that coast in Florida as full-scale targets. We've talked about FSTs. I don't know. Pilots have really good eyes. And pilots also know, they know what they've seen. And any good pilot probably knows, especially if this is a senior pilot, even if they're just flying a CRJ, they know what a Phantom is. They looked at them when they were kids. They built models. He said it looked like an F-4 Phantom. That's a very specific thing. He didn't say it looked like some multi-copter. He said it looked like a Phantom. Now, mind you, if there's some, I'll let Max bleep this out, some jackasses flying radio-controlled airplanes at 2,300 feet near an airport, they need to be found and taken away and put away. I mean, that's...
It's irresponsible.
It's irresponsible, and we don't like stupid around here. It doesn't help anybody's case. But it doesn't help the FAA's case. It suddenly, well, look at this example, right? I don't know. It was just, there's a lot of unknowns on this, and we probably won't know all the details, although U.S. Airways is saying they're conducting their own investigation beyond the FAA. But if it was really that serious, you'd think we would have heard something before it. Yes, there might have been, if there was an incursion next to the airplane, and it was someone flying a radio-controlled airplane, which it might have been a ducted fan or an actual turbojet, then that person is really bad. But if the details are ambiguous, you can't really use it for an argument to say that UAVs are bad. I just don't know why they would do that.
And, you know, the press, the mainstream press is, you know, once again, kind of taking this and you know, running with it and painting the picture of, the, you know, the sky is falling or that, you know, airliners may be falling because people are out there flying flying small drones. I read an article, there was an article in Business Insider, and the photograph, the drone photograph associated with the article was actually a picture of the new Parrot drone that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. And
but it wasn't a Predator or a Reaper or a DJI
right.
Phantom. So we're moving along here, folks.
I guess. But the FAA is certainly leveraging this to try to justify the positions that they've been taking. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but it's maybe it's inappropriate. The mainstream press is kind of running wild with it as well, at least some of them, and that's not warranted either. We don't have enough facts. There isn't enough verified information to know just exactly what this object was, what this aircraft was, and who was controlling it, if anyone. So, yeah, I mean, I hope we do get that information at some point, because as it stands right now, you really can't draw any conclusions.
So I guess we should talk about motorcycles.
Okay, Yamahas.
Yamaha motorcycles. Now, back, I don't know, 6 or 7 episodes, we talked about finding out that Japan has got more agricultural helicopters and drones than any place else in the world. And you and I sort of went, really? But evidently, Yamaha R-Max agricultural helicopter is all over Japan and is now becoming part of Northrop Grumman's Bat line of small aircraft systems. Interestingly, they used to build a radio-controlled airplane called the Bat. This was from Peter Bauer, AIN Online. Northrop Grumman and Yamaha announce an RBAT UAV.
The two companies are linking up, as you mentioned, to create something they're going to call the Rotary Bat. That's where RBAT comes from, based on this Yamaha R-Max agricultural helicopter. The Grumman Bat line, the current Bat line of small and unmanned aircraft systems, is fixed wing. At least the Bat UAS is a fixed wing, multi-mission, medium altitude aircraft. It's got an electronic fuel-injected engine, a Hirth engine. The Bat currently has a 10 or 12-foot wingspan, although Northrop is talking about a 20-foot wingspan design that's under development. So they're working with Yamaha, who brings this R-Max, which is it's a 2.7-meter long helicopter that can carry either tanks for liquid spray or tanks for granular sprayer for that kind of solid spray that's used for agricultural applications. So it's interesting that I can't really call this consolidation yet. We're not at the point where the industry is consolidating, but we are seeing examples like this where companies are pooling their intellectual resources to proceed forward in this market. So that's interesting. I imagine we'll see some other things like this, particularly as companies try to sort of migrate from being military UAV providers and they look ahead towards this commercial market. So, you know, there's the customer is different, the applications are different, and maybe Northrop Grumman linking up with Yamaha is an example of how a company like Northrop Grumman can enter into the commercial UAV market more successfully.
Diversification.
That's the key.
Parrot. Let's talk about Parrot. Parrot's new drone lets you simulate flying feet on the ground. This was from Yahoo.com via one of our favorite listeners, Lisa. Wonder who that is, Max. Parrot's new drone lets you simulate flying. So Parrot Bebop's quadcopter has a flying high-quality fisheye camera, first-person view, powered by your smartphone or tablet. You know, I'm thinking if I'm going to go down this U and get one, I think I want to get a Parrot because the whole thing about flying a UAV from my cell phone just blows my mind.
Isn't that incredible? Well, an option for this Bebop, which will be available around fourth quarter of 2014, an option is the Sky Controller. And this is a twin joystick controller that it extends the Wi-Fi range up to 2 kilometers. Normally, the range is about 300 meters. That's if you're using your smartphone or tablet. But, you know, the really interesting thing to me is that this thing is basically a flying camera. And it's got a wide view fisheye lens, 180-degree fisheye lens, that has a raw image size of 14 megapixels, but which sounds like an awful lot. But what they do is that instead of moving the camera lens to change the angle or the direction or moving the entire quadcopter, it's done with software. And what it does is it takes a 2-megapixel image out of that larger fisheye, and you can direct that, you can point that so that the quadcopter and the camera can remain stationary, but you can move what it's videoing through this software control. So that lets them create something that's much lighter. You don't need a gimbal. You don't need some mechanisms to point the camera, at least not to the same degree. So it's fascinating. It's designed to be flown either indoors or outdoors. It's not that large. And they talk about a 12-minute flight time. We don't know the price yet. They haven't announced the price. So it's, I don't know. We'll see how expensive it is. Maybe it's a DJI Phantom competitor.
But you also forgot to mention that it can sync to Oculus Rift virtual reality headsets.
Yes, that's right. So you have that option as well.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to fly like that. It starts becoming Star Wars and you put your blast shield down so you can use your lightsaber. How's that for a geeky reference? I don't know. I kind of like looking in down the onto the iPad screen of Parker's Hex, but I know a lot of people want to use the headsets.
And we'll put a link to a video. There's an AvWeb video from the AUVSI show in Orlando, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes that gives you an idea what this thing looks like and how it operates.
Not as good a video of the week as mine was.
I know. So, yeah, this week, the video of the week is David's video, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes where you can find that on YouTube. Are we going to have just one, or do you think we'll have more than one in the...
I think the other one is on par, which was the AT Black Knight Transformer is an autonomous flying truck. Originally, DARPA had set up a program where, in all simplest terms, they wanted Humvees that could fly. And this is the first result of DARPA's contest, and this is pretty awesome. It's... I guess we would call it an octocopter. It's got 8 rotors.
Right.
But basically, it drives like a 4-wheel drive, and then it can fly like a drone to deliver stuff. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and this came in from Mick, so we want to thank him for that. Yeah, this is a big thing. I mean, this is 31 feet long. It's 19 feet wide and 8 feet tall. So with a gross weight of 4,400 pounds. So this is a big device. The video is just the sort of the initial testing that shows the driving tests and sort of initial hovering test. So I'll put a link to that video in the show notes as well. David, we did get a brief recording from one of our listeners, Nathan Knoll. He's been at the Small Unmanned Systems Business Expo. And he sent along a brief recording with some of his observations from the show.
Hey, Max and David. This is Nathan Knoll. I'm here at the Small Unmanned Systems Business Expo in Presidio Park on the beautiful San Francisco Bay. It's day 2 of the show, and it's mostly been focused on UAS and UAV business owners. There's been some exhibiting and presenting by vendors, and then also some advocacy and discussion of what else but FAA regulations. The main headliner here is Jim Williams. He's the FAA manager for the UAS Integration Office. He spoke about some of the recent incidents and their implications. His big point was emphasizing that the recent NTSB ruling with the Perker case is being taken out of context and nothing's really changed. The FAA is still appealing. There was a Q&A session. It was respectful, but, you know, definitely with some passion people and questions. So a really, really interesting thing available online. On YouTube, they have videos and things like that. We definitely recommend you guys check it out. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Nathan. Really appreciate you sending that along to us. David, I think we're going to have some more information about that expo next episode.
Well, let's hope. We're going to try to get all of our contacts that were at the Small Unmanned and AUSVI. So, or AUVSI, I'm sorry. But I want to say something, folks. Nathan used his smartphone to make that recording. So if you guys go to a UAV event, send us a little voice message like that. We love hearing from our listeners, and we are an audio podcast, so good audio like that makes it even better. So we want to encourage this behavior. Nathan, thank you for being the first person to do that and taking the time. But yeah, if there's something you want to leave feedback, you want to leave audio feedback, all you have to do is take your phone, record something, and then send us the file. Max and I definitely want to hear it, and especially if it's an event focusing on UAVs. He and I can't get everywhere as much as we want to try. But yeah, definitely, Nathan, thank you for that. And remember, feedback at theuavdigest.com.
All right. You've been listening to episode 40 of the UAV Digest. And you can be sure to find us at theuavdigest.com. And show notes for this episode are theuavdigest.com/40 for episode 40. David, where else can folks find us?
Our website, of course, is theuavdigest.com. At Twitter, at UAV Digest. On Facebook, facebook.com/UAV Digest. And iTunes and Stitcher.com. And remember, on either one of those two, if you really like our show, remember to leave us feedback. It's the way we get out to the rest of the world so we can spread the word of good people flying good drones, doing good things. And don't forget, you could always advertise us by purchasing us some swag at cafepress.com/theuavdigest. So on that note, folks, until next week, I'm David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.